I'm starting this quite late, about half an hour late, due to my stupidly forgetting to turn on the camera. All right. Stop me if I've told you this story already. I've got a number of sort of neat medieval Islamic stories that I use for teaching, and I can't always remember who I've told which one. A certain vizier was traveling about the countryside, taking petitions and giving alms and dealing with what must be dealt with. And he received a petition for alms from a poor old woman, and he wrote out, "Pay this woman 200 dinar," and he gave the woman the writing to take to his treasurer. And the treasurer, looking at what his master had written, was astonished that his master would give so large a sum in alms to a poor woman. And so he went back to the vizier and he said, "Master, is this your writing?" And the vizier answered, "It was my intention to write, 'Pay this woman 200 dirham.' But since it was the will of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, that I write dinar instead of dirham, that my hand slipped, I wrote dinar instead of dirham, gold instead of silver, therefore pay it out as it is written." And so it was commanded, and so it was done. 3 days later, the vizier received a petition from a poor old man. And the man's petition said that 3 days before, the vizier had given his wife 200 dinar. And she had now decided that she was too wealthy to be married to a poor old man like him, and was threatening to force her husband to divorce her. And the man asked the vizier to appoint somebody in authority to prevent his wife from making him divorce her. And the vizier thought a moment, took paper and pen, and wrote, "Pay this man 200 dinar." All right. So what's the implication of this story? This is a society in which it is legally easy for husbands to divorce wives and almost impossible for wives to divorce husbands. But the implication is that not only could the wife... How do you think the wife is going to force her husband to divorce her? Exactly. Make being married to her so unpleasant that he'd rather be divorced. And the assumption is that the vizier, who's much more powerful than any of these people, as a practical matter, can't stop her, and it's therefore simpler and easier just to give a compensating amount of money to the husband. Now, of course, one would like to know whether the whole thing was a put-up act by the two of them, but that at least the story. This is from about a 10th century source. It's quite a neat book, which was written by a man called Al-Tanuki, who was a judge in Baghdad, a Qadi. And he starts the book by saying that the stories that are told in sort of polite conversation by people who entertain each other aren't nearly as good as the ones he remembers when he was young. And he decided to do something about it. So he's going to write down every story he can remember from. And they're anecdotes. They're not Thousand Nights and a Night story. They're stories about, Caliph so-and-so did such-and-such, Vizier so-and-so said such-and-such, and things of that sort. But anyway, I think it's a neat example of the difficulties, even in a very traditional society, of enforcing the marriage contract if somebody really wants to breach it. The line I used in one of my books was that, as far as I know, no wife has ever been sued for cooking badly, let alone making love badly. So what's changed? Why is the world different? And my short answer is that what makes divorce more common is that the magnitude of those sunk costs has dropped strikingly over the last couple hundred years. And one big reason is the end of infant mortality. That in modern developed societies, something under one child, one infant in 100 dies. A century or two back, it was more like 1 in 3, and a noticeable number of others died before they made it to adulthood. The higher infant mortality is, the more children you've got to produce in order to get a given number of children when you're finished. And producing children and bringing up infants is a very large part of the wife's part of that joint project. So that meant that the scale of the wife's job, as it were, went down by maybe a factor of 2 or so, or maybe a factor of 3, over a period of a century or two. Furthermore, a lot of household production got shifted out of the household. So that there's an essay somewhere by Dorothy Sayers. I don't know if any of you have read her. She was an English mystery writer of the period between World War I and World War II. Very good in the sense that her best books are really good novels, not just fun whodunits. But she, I think, was also one of the early women to go to Oxford when they had just started letting women in and was sort of in general had strong views about roles of women. And she's got a comment somewhere that people complain about women taking men's jobs away. And she says, well, look, I want to offer you a deal. We'll stop taking men's jobs away if you'll give back all the women's jobs. And that includes the whole clothing industry, because after all, clothing used to be mostly sewed in the home by the wife. The whole meat food preserving industry, making sausage, you know, ham, all that stuff used to be done in the household. The brewing industry and so forth. And the point, which is a legitimate historical point, is that there are a whole lot of activities which, with increasing division of labor, shifted from being done in the household to being done out on the marketplace. Mostly those were activities that women did, and therefore the combined effect of that and dropping infant mortality made the job of wife, which used to consume nearly half the adult labor force of the world, go to being really a part-time job. For most, I mean, there are exceptions. Obviously, there are couples where they're having a lot of kids or they're back-to-the-land movement types and they're still, you know, curing hams and things. But for the normal pattern, being a wife is a full-time job for a few years while you're producing and bringing up kids. But if you imagine sort of your normal working life of 45 years or so, maybe a majority of that, being a wife is really a part-time job, largely putting up with your husband. And so the lower the sum, there are advantages to divorce as well as disadvantages, obviously, and the lower the costs of breaking it up, the more willing people are to do it. So I would like to claim that that's at least a significant element in why marriage became less stable. However, as we shift to divorce on demand, this raises a new problem of opportunistic reach. A friend of mine, Lloyd Cohen, wrote this very good article called one of the titles was I Gave Him the Best Years of My Life. I forget what the subtitle was. But he was basically making this very simple point that if we imagine a two-person contract where you do your part of our joint project early and I do my part late, if we don't have enforceable contracts, I'm going to dump you halfway through because I've got a lot out of you and why should I have to pay for it? And Cohen Lloyd, I think, very imprudently put the argument in terms of value on the marriage market. What he said is that women depreciate early and men depreciate late on the marriage market, that a 40-year-old divorcee is a lot less marriageable than a 40-year-old divorced woman is a lot less marriageable than a 40-year-old divorced man. And the way he should have put it, both because it's clearer and because it's less offensive to feminists who want to like his stuff but didn't, is that women perform early and men perform late in a traditional marriage. The women are most fertile in the early years, they're most capable of dealing with small children in the fertile years, in the early years, and therefore in the traditional pattern, they're spending the first decade of marriage working really hard, you know, 18-hour-a-day job producing and taking care of kids, while the husband is in the process of getting established in his career. And some point thereafter, as the kids go off to high school or elementary school or whatever, they're out of the house, wife's job is becoming easier and easier, and the husband's income is getting higher and higher, so that the wife has done sort of the hard part of her job early, the husband's major contribution late, and Lloyd Cohen points out that's a temptation to opportunistic breach if we don't have enforceable contracts. So he's then describing the pattern of the successful husband dumping his wife, marrying a trophy bride, so to speak, and it's affected by the fact that men find younger women more attractive, and therefore he's got an incentive to do it. He might want more kids, and the younger woman can produce more kids, and so forth. So, but Lloyd Cohen went on to say, once this pattern is clear, people adjust their behavior, that if the women know that there's a risk of this, well, there are two responses they can make. One of them is don't specialize as much in household production. Hire a nanny and be a lawyer. Eat in restaurants instead of cooking dinner. And use the time to earn money out in the marketplace. So now you're less vulnerable if a breach occurs. But the other is try to shift the timing of your performance, so instead of getting married and immediately starting having kids, get married, wait a few years, have a kid, maybe wait a few years, have a kid, and so forth. And there are limits to doing that, of course, because women somewhere, I guess, in their 40s become less able to bear children, and the risks of birth defects go up and various other problems of that sort go up. But since you only need two or three kids, unless you really want a lot, you've got a fair amount of room for adjusting in the modern world. And so Lloyd at least argued that the observed pattern both of women shifting to more marketplace production and of later childbirth and later marriages, all of that fitted the pattern of people rationally adjusting to the unenforceable contracts. So I think that was an interesting story, and it might even be right. How about the out-of-wedlock birth part? And that's increased a whole lot even over the last 40 years or so. Maybe it's 50 by now. I don't remember when I wrote that PowerPoint first. And it's not only in the U.S., it's across sort of the developed world, and it's not only among the poor. That is, one explanation which some people like to offer is that what's happening is you've got various forms of welfare where when you have kids, the government gives you more money, so that means that poor welfare mothers can make a living producing babies they're not going to pay for. No doubt some of that happens, but that can't be an adequate explanation of what's happening, because you also observe an increase, though not as large an increase, at least in the U.S., in out-of-wedlock birth among women who are not in the sort of cohort which is ever likely to be on welfare. And at least in Scandinavia, which I think was ahead of us in these set of developments, as far as I can tell, it's pretty much through the income distribution that's now happening. What about some other possible causes? It doesn't have to be only one cause, obviously, but one of them might be that if there are more women and more men, then men are in a stronger bargaining position than women. And if there are quite a lot of men who would like sex but don't want the responsibility of taking care of children or of paying for children, then the stronger the market position of men is, the more we'll be able to get that deal, and then you end up out of wedlock. And the reason you could imagine that happening in the 20th century is that if you think about it, until about 100 years ago, the single most dangerous thing that any really large number of people did was to have a baby. All right? Human beings are not good at having babies. The reason human beings are not good at having babies compared to other mammals is that humans have big heads. And you've got a constraint that the head has got to get through the pelvic canal, essentially. You can solve that constraint in several different ways. You can make the pelvis wider, and women, in fact, have wider pelvises than men. The problem is that apparently the mechanics of walking and running are such that as you widen the pelvis, the result is that you're not as good at running, which means you get eaten by tigers, some risk of being eaten by tigers in the past. So that I gather that at least in the case of track, there really is a reason why, on average, men are somewhat better at track than women. And I suspect if you look, though I don't know, that the women who are track stars probably are women with relatively narrow pelvises. That's a guess. It might not be true. So that's one constraint, which human beings have indeed adapted by somewhat wider pelvises. Second thing you can do is to have the child born earlier, because the earlier the child is born, the smaller the infant is. Human beings are born prematurely by the standards of almost, I think, any other mammal. If you think about, you know, a horse bears a foal, and the foal, a few minutes, stands up and, you know, walks around in a wobbly kind of way. Babies, it's going to be a year before they're standing up and walking around. So we've pushed that, but of course that's risky as well, because the more premature the child is, the harder it is to keep it alive until it gets big enough to do things. And the third thing you do is you have death in childbirth. That is to say, you have a tighter set of constraints than you would like to have, and the result is that sometimes it doesn't work. So my guess, and I don't have the data, is that if you looked at the population 400 years ago, that you would have found a relatively high male-female ratio among adults due to women dying in childbirth. That's a guess. I don't have the data. If so, that would mean that the women were in a better bargaining position and therefore better able to say, I won't sleep with you unless you'll marry me and support my children. 20th century, we've eliminated death in childbirth pretty much for developed countries. We've also had some pretty horrendous wars, although that's not having much effect at this stage, as we're you're a population which was not thinned by war. That I think all U.S. wars, even including Korea, since World War II, have been very small propositions by historical standards in terms of how large a fraction of the population actually got killed. World War I, on the other hand, in Europe, and to extent also even in the U.S. and World War II, really killed a lot of people, and that presumably increased the bargaining power of men over women, and maybe you could argue that would affect it. Now, one could argue, in the U.S., however, if you actually look at the ratios, there isn't a very large female-male ratio, except in the sort of older age groups because of men dying earlier, except if you think about the populations which we most associate with two births out of childbirth, which is basically the inner-city population. That's an area where an awful lot of men are in prison, due largely to the drug laws, and that presumably does mean that women are in a weak bargaining position and men in a strong bargaining. And finally, as another explanation, is rising income. That after all, some women would say, well, it's not that I can't get a husband. Why should I have to put up with a husband when I can afford to do without one? There's some famous quote about the old maid who's asked why she marries. She says, why should I have to marry? I've got a tomcat who goes out at night, a chimney that smokes, and a parrot that swears. What do I need a husband for? So that's another explanation. There's a rather neat argument by two economists. One of them, Akerlof, is the person who's associated with the economics of adverse selection. He's the author of the Market for Lemons article that I think I told you about at some point in the past. And Yellen is a co-author. And they have an argument which they make in rather fancy game theoretic terms, which are quite unnecessary. But the basic argument is a neat argument. And the implication of the argument is exactly the opposite of what was predicted, that we've had a movement during roughly my lifetime towards good contraception being legally and easily available and towards legal abortion being readily available. And in both cases, one of the arguments for doing those things was getting rid of, quote, unwanted children, meaning bastards only. People don't like to use that word because it's a pejorative word. And not clear. It should be pejorative, but it is. Anyway, Akerlof and Yellen said, no, actually the effect of those changes is to increase the number of births out of wedlock, not decrease it. And the argument, which is neat because it's an economic argument, is looking at the market, as it were, on which people are agreeing for sex and related things, including child support. And the argument is that men, especially young men, are more interested in having sex than women, although young women, they also want sex. What does that mean from an economist standpoint, thinking in terms of the demand curve? How much you want something depends on its price. So it doesn't mean that if women were rewarded for having sex and men were shot for having sex, then men would want more sex. But it means that if you had arrangements in which the costs to both, including the cost of any resulting children, were evenly divided, then the men would want more sex than the women less. But in fact, the costs aren't evenly divided, because prior to abortion and contraception, sex and pregnancy are joint products, that having one results in a probability of the other. Given that, if you have sex without marriage or similar commitments, the woman is bearing most of the cost, and the man is getting at least half and maybe more than half of the benefit. And the result is that lots of women were unwilling to have sex without some guarantee that if the result was pregnancy, they would get supported, which could either be marriage or an engagement in a society in which that was in effect a binding contract. Or even a society with shotgun weddings, a society where it was understood that if you got your girlfriend pregnant, you would have to marry her. Any of those. So now you introduce reliable birth control and readily available abortion. Now sex and pregnancy are separated. They're not joint products anymore. And that means that those women who don't at the moment want children, but who enjoy sex, are willing to have sex with men without any guarantees. That means that the women who want children are in a worse bargaining position. That after all, one way of putting the old situation was it was a good deal for a woman who wanted children, because not only would a man help her to have children, which he enjoyed doing too, he'd even help support them. Now the man says, sorry, that other woman who doesn't want children is willing to go to bed with me too, so why should I commit to marry you? Some women, however, really want to have children, and then the argument, the Akerlof-Yellen argument, is that the result is that some of them choose to have children even without a husband, or with a boyfriend who they hope will become a husband, but they aren't sure, without a secure commitment. And one point that that sort of suggests, which I think is probably right, is that this whole unwanted children business was bogus from the beginning. That is, that the implicit assumption of the way people talked about why you needed abortion and contraception was that almost all births to unmarried women were in fact unwanted, were the result, were, as people used to say, accidents caused people, were the result of contraceptive failure or not knowing about contraception or whatever. And I think the evidence of what's happened is that that was almost certainly not right, that certainly some were, but that an awful lot of that were women who, for one reason or another, wanted a baby, couldn't find a suitable husband, and were willing to do without. Anyway, what are the consequences from an economist's standpoint? These changes benefit those women who don't want children. They can now have sex. They don't want the guarantee of support and do without children. Men are better off. Why are men better off? Some of them don't want children. Great, they get to have sex with women who don't want children. Some of them want children, but they can get better terms. Better terms might include marriage, but it's a marriage in which, since their bargaining power is better, the woman is willing to do a larger part of the relevant division of the man. Yes. Children, that gets very unclear. A lot of people argue children are worse off, and I'm not competent to judge how large an effect that's really true. One side point, which is worth mentioning, and that is whenever people make claims along the lines of boys without fathers are more likely to become criminals or whatever, one question you want to ask is, are they controlling for genetics? Because when you claim parents influence their children, parents influence their children in two quite different ways. One of them is they provide the genes for the children, and one of them is they provide a part of the environment for the children. And there's quite a good book called The Nurture Assumption by Judith Harris. It came out 10 or 20 years ago. New edition recently came out, and she argues that a lot of the stuff that was being said about child rearing is false, and that it came from observing correlations between children and parents and assuming they were doing good child rearing. And that if you control for genetics by looking at adopted children, her claim is that most of those results disappear. So I don't know if I'm not saying that being brought up without a father has no bad consequences. Very likely it does, but only that when people say it has bad consequences, you have to think about, did they figure out whether the bad consequences were the result of being brought up without a father or the result of being the child of a man who was willing to abandon his children, who had whatever psychological characteristics made him willing to do that, which he then passes on to his
children. There's at least, I'm not sure what it is, contrary evidence. They've done longitudinal studies for crime rates.
Yes.
And they found that generally people across strata, across income ranges, commit crime at the same rate, but that education is the best predictor about whether or not a criminal who engages in crime will get caught. Which, so if you're looking at criminal behavior as opposed to child rearing, it'd be more useful.
You'll be getting a biased sample.
Right. I've heard of that book, and I'm a little bit skeptical,
yeah.
If only because the nature versus nurture argument is one that is an indescribably tangled mess, because you have the environment plus genetics equals 1 plus 1 might equal 3.
Absolutely true. But as a matter of fact, she's not talking about nature versus... She's not talking about genetics versus environment. Because Judith Harris's argument is not that environment doesn't matter, but that nurture doesn't matter. Her argument is that the family, it's not really about personality, that the family environment is not the main influence on the adult personality, it's the peer group environment that's the main, and genetics that's the main influence. And that the reason that people got it wrong was that the parents usually are providing the genes, and therefore, by her view, the parents' genetic contribution and the peer group's environmental contribution are what give the adult personality. But anyway, read the book. She is not an unsophisticated writer. That is, she clearly is thinking about a lot of these issues. And in fact, she's got a second book, which is investigating the puzzle of why people who are genetically identical come out differently. And in particular, sort of her the case she starts with is a case of two conjoined Iranian twins who as young adults finally had an operation to separate them, which in fact killed them, it turned out, unfortunately. But her point is that these are two people who not only had identical genes, they had never been more than a foot apart from each other in their life, so they had the identical environment, and yet they had quite different personalities by all accounts. So the second book is an attempt to explore that question. But anyway, so this is a possible explanation. It's sort of an intriguing economic explanation when you think of sex and marriage as economic behavior with people rationally seeking their objectives and so forth, of why you might have had an increase. But we have had an increase, so it's impossible. Next bit is another piece of economics done by somebody else who I know slightly, and I think is sort of neat, which is an article by Mark. Just confused two different Peggy's, two different law professors. His first name is Margaret. And I think it's not Peggy. I think Peggy Radin is the other one. She's the commodification person at Stanford. And this is, I'm not forgetting her last name. But anyway, she does neat stuff. And she has an interesting and maybe even correct article on the history of engagement rings. All right? Which we sort of take for, I don't know, to what extent is it still a serious custom? If you were proposing to a woman, would you expect to buy her a moderately expensive engagement ring as part of the process?
Yes, or still would. Having her tell all her friends that you're a very bad person.
All right, because the discussion, as I remember in her article, suggests that the custom has declined more recently. But her account, basically, is this is not an ancient custom, or at least not an ancient custom. It was very common. That in 1900, if I got her version right, you know, not that nobody ever did it, but it was not taken for granted that you would do this. That she argues it was, in fact, just as in the earlier case, a response of people to legal changes that put them at risk. All right, we argued that the changes in marital patterns were a response in part to divorce becoming available more or less at will. And her argument is, consider a traditional society, women want sex, women don't want to risk being seduced and abandoned, in part because they will then be much less marriageable. On the marriage market as it then existed, men like virgins, men think of a woman who gets herself pregnant in particular as sort of irresponsible and not a good catch and so forth. And one's traditional solution is you can have sex before marriage, but you have it with the man you're going to marry, and both of you know that if you get pregnant, he marries you. And there are actually some data. Somebody looked at records for several European cities around 1900 or so for date of marriage and date of first birth. And it turns out that about a third of all brides were pregnant. So, you know, we think of sort of sex before marriage as a modern invention, but it's not so. But it depended on the man having this obligation. And in common law countries, including in the U.S., it was an obligation that was in fact enforceable. That there was a tort action for breach of promise to marry, which at least she argues was really a tort suit for loss of virginity. Even though it wasn't in that form. And that made it easier to have the solution because the man would be at risk of losing lots of money if he seduced his fiancée and then dumped her. This action was abandoned by the courts over a period of a decade or two, in I think the 30s. The claim is that the rise of the custom of giving valuable engagement rings parallels the decline of this legal action. And that what was going on was a performance bond. That you can jilt her and no, she can't sue you, but she'll keep the ring. And at a point in which that ring is, I don't know, a month's salary or something, I don't know quite how it was, but I think it was a significant amount of value, that's a noticeable reason only to give her the ring if in fact you want to marry her and are willing to do so if she gets pregnant. And then her claim, as I remember, was what she had were data on diamond sales, I should say. That was how she was measuring it. And I think her conclusion was that they had later declined due to the fact that basically men care a lot less than they used to about whether the men, women they marry are virgins, and women who choose to engage in sex outside of marriage are much less likely to get pregnant than they used to due to the fact that we've got better contraception. So that was sort of a neat bit of economics applied to all of this stuff. One more bit, and this one I'm responsible for. I've never actually written it up except for mentioning it in books, but I've thought of doing an article on it, and I don't know if I'm right about it. But this has to do with seduction law. That in 19th century English and American law, you have a situation, again, where daughter is seduced and pregnant, and we will assume that there was no promise of marriage, so you can't sue for that. Nonetheless, there is a suit, and the legal form of the suit is that the father is suing as a master collecting damages for injury to a servant. There was a legal action under which if, I think it would even apply to employees as well as to servants. I think they're using servant in a fairly broad legal sense. So if you injure the foreman of my factory tortiously, not only can he sue, I can sue because the factory is closed down until I find another foreman. And the courts were willing to let fathers sue for the pregnancy of their daughters, even if the daughter was not in any ordinary sense a servant. There's one case where the court says, even if all the daughter is doing is acting as hostess for the tea for her father once a week, that's enough to make her count as a servant. And the legal, if you look at the sort of legal discussion of this rather odd legal practice, the explanation is the daughter can't sue on her own behalf for injury because she's got unclean hands, that fornication is illegal, therefore she has been a willing participant in a crime, therefore she can't sue for damages that result from that crime, therefore they use the fiction of this master-servant relationship to get around that problem. Might be right, but it occurred to me from reading 18th century stuff that there was another interesting possibility, and that was that what they are calling seduction might in fact have been a way of getting around paternal control over marriage. So that you can imagine the case where the woman falls in love with a man. We can imagine for a moment the man in fact is willing. She believes at least he's willing to marry her, but the father doesn't approve. And so she says to her boyfriend, you know, if you get me pregnant, he's going to have to let you marry me. And if the woman could sue for seduction, then that would not be a threat to prevent this happening because she's the one who wants to do it. Whereas if her father can sue for seduction, can say, I won't let you marry her and I'm going to sue you for lots of money, then that gives him a weapon to help him control who his daughter marries. And part of the reason that this occurred to me is that one of my favorite sources on 18th century life is Casanova's memoirs. And I can think of at least one scene, there may be more than one, where he is involved with a woman, she wants to marry him, he says, and probably at the time believes he wants to marry her, her father refuses to consent, and the two of them agree that if he can get her pregnant, father will have to give consent, and set about trying to arrange that, unsuccessfully, I think. I think the parents pull her away and put her in a nunnery or something, as I remember at some point in this. This is all happening in Venice in 1750, somewhere around there. But it does at least suggest that that kind of strategy, that you would expect, just given human nature, that in a society where the father controls the daughter's marriage, there's going to be a lot of potential tension when the daughter either doesn't want to marry the person who the father wants her to marry. You see that case in Casanova as well. There's a very different case there. Or in which she does want to marry somebody else. And that this legal rule could have been a way around that. So that's a conjecture by me, but I thought it was sort of a fun conjecture. All right. Let's go on to some legal regulation, and I want to start with the case of the baby market. So, legally speaking, a woman can transfer parental rights, but she can't sell parental rights. And I gather this is evaded in various ways, that the adoptive parents can pay for the medical expenses of the woman, they can pay legal expenses, presumably they could pay legal expenses and the lawyer could slip the woman, the mother, some money under the table, as it were. I don't know how much of that happens. But it is the case, I gather, that actually adopting kids is quite expensive. I don't remember. I think it's in the tens of thousands of dollars is what it ends up costing, typically. So, the question is why isn't the direct payment legal? And let me start with the question as a gut reaction to all of you. Do you share or not share the feeling that there's something wrong with adoptive parents being able to pay the natural mother for her consent to the adoption? Does that feel wrong or not wrong to you? Feels fine to you. Yeah. Well, you're outliers, I think, which is to say why Dick Posner isn't going to be on the Supreme Court, I would guess. Can we explain the feeling? Certainly put that way, it's selling rights with regard to a human being. I want to claim, and I'll get back to this in a minute after we talk a little about prostitution, that part of it ties into something that I don't clearly understand, but that's clearly there. And that's the hostility to money and social interactions. So that, to take a sort of inoffensive but pretty clear example, suppose my wife and I invite a friend over for dinner and have a good time, a nice dinner party. And we do it again. And suppose the circumstances are such that that it isn't easy for the friends to invite us over for dinner, which is the sort of most common pattern as you exchange it. But I'll let you think up an imaginary reason why they can't. They don't cook. They only go to restaurants or something. And what do? They might very well invite us out to a restaurant, with the understanding that they'll pay for the restaurant because they're returning, sort of, they're paying their social debt from our inviting them over for dinner. What is the one thing they would never do that would be absolutely taboo would be to say to us, well, we figure you've given us the equivalent of a $20 a person restaurant meal twice now, so we, between us, owe you $80. Here's $80. Very hard to imagine anybody in our culture doing that. You agree? Why? That's the puzzle. The version that I gave in my price theory textbook where I first discussed this, which various people found offensive, was to say that we regard as normal, though not necessarily approved of, behavior the man who takes a woman out to a fancy restaurant in the hope she'll go to bed with him later in the evening. Some women will say, well, you shouldn't do that. Some people will, but it's within the range of social behavior. Offering her cash for the same purpose is a flat insult. All right? Everybody knows it. How do we understand it? So go back to prostitution, which of course is offering cash for the same thing. And then the question is, why is it that in most human societies, certainly in many human societies, and in almost all of the ones similar to ours, prostitution, although it exists, is illegal? Any guesses? Any good reasons? Illegal. Well, except that religion would make fornication illegal. But why don't we say it's illegal whether you're paid for it or not if you're not married? Which, of course, is also, I mean, it is not de facto the case in the U.S. at present, but it certainly, in the law, was, probably in some states still is, but certainly in the law, it was the case not very long ago that having sex with somebody you weren't married to was illegal. That's what fornication was. And so why separately make it illegal to pay for it?
Well, I can think of at least one maybe plausible reason, and that's that you can police the monetary transaction. That you can control it because you can at least track money, but you can't really track people's privately ordered behavior.
I would have thought if anything it was the other way around, that it takes longer to have sex with somebody than it is to hand them a $20 bill. And that as a practical matter, you can't, as long as people use cash, you can't track monetary activities very well.
I don't think they may make sense outside of like some of those like moral ideas. That's just kind of.
But are moral ideas just random?
I think it's just sort of how we hold it shaped.
Why does this prohibition exist across quite as I said, not all cultures? New Zealand is now legal.
Fear of trafficking in sex. Somewhere.
Why are people afraid of trafficking in sex? That is, all I'm saying is that you observe that when you observe patterns of human behavior, it seems to you ought to be curious. Why, especially when it's a pattern which is common across a bunch of different societies? I'm not saying I have an answer, by the way. That from my standpoint, one way of looking at it is that it's part of this general, not very easy to explain, hostility to money. To money in certain contexts. That somehow it's as if there's a sort of a world of social interactions where money is taboo, and then a world of business interactions where it's acceptable. And it's hard to know why people feel that way, and yet it seems, at least in our culture, related culture, to be pretty common. So that if people say, well, sex is a sort of very intimate thing, and therefore it shouldn't be tainted by money. And there is an article, and I think this one is by Peggy Radin, I think. Why am I forgetting the other one's name? Fairly famous article from, again, like 20 years ago, about where she used the term commodification. And her... Oh, for a moment, I just should mention again, another example of the pattern is the business of gift cards. Our gift cards are just crazy. If I'm going to give you $20 to buy a present, why do I give you $20 on the condition that you spend it in a particular store? The answer is because it's not cash. It feels a little bit more like a gift. There's the general puzzle of why we give gifts instead of cash at all, but that we can let that pass for the moment. It's another interesting puzzle. All right, let me go. Yes. So one possible answer for prostitution is that the pressure is the feeling that the existence of prostitution competes with marriage. That if you say, look, either if you say, I am a woman, I want to live in a society where I can get myself a husband, or if you say, well, I may or may not be a woman, but I want to live in a society in which the next generation are brought up by husband and wife pairs, not by a prostitute living on the street, and therefore I want to make marriage more attractive, we then go back to the argument which, however crass it may seem, says that marriage in part consists of the woman agreeing to provide sex in exchange for support. And if we like that long-term contract, we then might oppose the short-term versions as competing with it. So that would be one possible explanation. The other one, which I find interesting, although very unpersuasive, this is Peggy Radin at Stanford's argument, is her position essentially is that the transaction of prostitution is not immoral, but that thinking of sex as the sort of thing that can be bought and sold is bad. That if people think of sex as a commodity, that will somehow undermine ordinary loving relationships and have other bad consequences, and that therefore, at least in the article, she was ambivalent as to whether prostitution should be illegal, but she thought an argument for making it illegal was that, and I think this goes back to the child market again, that you could say an argument for making explicit payments for adoption illegal is it commodifies babies, and we then start thinking of our babies as goods on the market and not as loving little people who we should take care of. I find it pretty nutty. I don't find that convincing, having had babies and wives and various other things. But the thing I find bizarre about that, legally speaking, is that it looks as though it precisely reverses the usual legal distinction between speech and action. Because what is her argument saying? Her argument is saying that when we have a transaction between a prostitute and her customer, there are two things happening. One of them is an actual physical transaction. She gets cash, she gets sex. The other is a statement that by doing this action, we are saying that's what sex is about. And what she wants to say is the action is all right, but we're going to ban the statement. Well, that sounds an awful lot like, a lot as though she is saying that there's an act which is legal as act, but illegal as speech. And we usually do just the opposite. We say, well, some acts that maybe are a bit illegal, we're going to protect because we need to protect free speech. And these are ways of expressing things. I don't know, throwing a pie in the face of a politician or something. I don't know if that's ever legal. But you could certainly see the argument that says, yes, it's assault, but it's a pretty minor assault, and it's a way of expressing speech, and therefore we might let it pass. And that strikes me as odd in that whole position. But I don't know if people are still paying attention, but the commodification argument at least got some attention a while back. All right, we're running out of time, so let me just raise the next issue, which should have been in my outline and wasn't, and that's the question of whether babies are a good thing. And of people you know, do people think of world overpopulation as as one of the serious threats nowadays? Not. All right.
I've read some of the underpopulation is actually a bigger problem. least developed or already developed countries as far as paying for like social security and things like that.
Yeah, that is, there is in fact a modern literature which argues that the European countries in particular are going to have declining populations in terms of their current birth rates. And some people worry about that, and maybe they should, I don't know. But certainly, now of course from an economist standpoint these are really the same issue. The general question is, are there positive or negative effects from having more children? But in terms of the public controversy, as I say, back when I was in college and a bit after, it was taken for granted by educated opinion, essentially, that a major reason why poor countries were poor was there were too many people in them, and that if you wanted to keep them from being poor, you had to spread birth control. You know, that was sort of, people put it in terms of arguments from Malthus, the Malthusian problem. Almost none of them had read Malthus, and they didn't correctly represent his argument, which is an interesting one, but that was sort of the way it was put. And the extreme version of this in China was the one-child policy, which was an attempt to forcibly force the birth rate well below replacement. But there was also a big effort to sort of spread knowledge and use of contraception in places like India. And in fact, the Indian government, which tended to be dominated by people who were sort of identified with elite intellectual views in the West, for a while was sort of pushing sterilization. And I think the government fell over that. If I remember correctly, I think one of the times, the first or second time that Congress Party went out of power, it was because they had been pushing sterilization and it was a massively unpopular policy in India. My friend Gordon Tullock likes to say that the way you know whether a country is really a democracy is by whether the party in power has lost two elections. That a party in power might lose one election by mistake. They could have rigged it, but they didn't realize they had to. But if they lose two elections, it's really a democracy rather than a fake democracy with a de facto one-party state. And for a fair while, it looked as though India was a one-party state, and then Congress, I don't know if Congress is in power at the moment, it at least lost a number of elections off and on. So anyway, we're out of time, so we'll go back to this later. But think about the question, when you have another baby, are there external costs you impose on other people? Are there external benefits? How would you figure out how big they are?